This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
So welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. This is the part of the program we call The Big Picture. And the purpose of this segment, I know you've heard me say this before, but we're awash in data points out there. And what we try to do is make sense of what is going on and tell you what all these data points mean. This week, we're going to be looking at credit risk. And you know, in times past, we have discussed at length the growing risk of some subprime auto loans. There is another area, which is the narrowing of interest rates between high and low quality bonds. And, you know, as an investor, you are not compensated for taking extra credit risks by investing in low quality bonds. We will take a look now at another popular sector with high tax investors, and that is municipal bonds. So lay the framework, Jim.
Well, you know, as we have been talking about, we're in what I call the melt-up stage and what we believe is the final stage or the last stage of a business cycle. And during that last stage, as you would expect, everything looks rosy in the markets and the economy. What do we talk about on the program? Every single week, it seems like the Dow or other indexes are hitting new records. But no matter how good things look today, another recession is coming sooner rather than later. The only problem is, it's very difficult to predict its actual arrival. It's kind of like, John, it reminds me of weather forecasting. It's just like the hurricanes that we had this summer. And I think it was Irma that was coming in to Florida, and they thought it was going to be a Category 5 rip through the state. Fortunately, as bad as that damage was, it was lowered to a level 2 from a level 5 and then headed westward, so it was spared a lot of damage. And that's a problem when you try to predict a recession. You're trying to predict its arrival. Many times, hurricanes, just like in weather, they can take a different course. For example, we've talked about here on the program, if we get some kind of fiscal stimulus with the House passing the budget as the next stage towards tax reform, that could extend the business cycle itself. But its timing and the course and severity are very difficult to predict. And this was something I brought up in my recent interview with A. Gary Schilling. I asked him, I said, do you see anything on the horizon? Because Gary is almost half in cash right now. And I asked him because, you know, his background, he has a PhD from Stanford and has been incredibly prescient in terms of making market calls and especially with interest rates. So I asked him what he thought or were the dangers were out there or was there anything lurking out there that would clue him into a recession. John, let's play that clip here. I want to move on to the business cycle. This is the third longest on record, what we're in year 8 or 9. Is there anything on the horizon that you think could bring about a recession other than, let's say, the Fed is insistent on keeping raising interest rates? We know if they keep doing that, eventually they can get a recession. But I'd like to get your take where we are in this business cycle. And if there was a danger of a recession, where would that danger come from? Would it be a financial shock or would it be something that the Fed does?
Well, those are the two choices historically. It's either been the Fed raising rates. They do that when they think the economy is overheating. By our count, they've tried that 12 times in the post-World War II period, and they wanted to effect a soft landing. They just wanted to cool things off. But in 11 of the 12 times, a recession resulted. The only soft landing was in the mid-90s. So when the Fed starts raising rates, as you point out, sooner or later, you can count on a recession. And on top of that, bear in mind that the Fed has had experience with interest rates for over a century. They've just recently begun to deal with this idea of unwinding this huge portfolio. This is the first time. They never built it up the way they did with quantitative easing. So that's a new experiment. And you say, what are the odds that they would be able to pull that off, successfully wind down that portfolio as well as raise interest rates without precipitating a recession? Now, that doesn't mean it's here today. That could be years away, and the Fed is moving very, very cautiously, at least so far. Now, the other cause of recessions, as you noted, is a shock. And we saw that with the dot-com blow-off in the late 90s, and we saw that, of course, with a collapse in subprime mortgages in the mid-2000s. Something like that, a financial shock. And that can do the same thing, precipitate a recession, and of course you get a bear market in stocks as well. Right now, and as you know, Jim, I've made a career out of looking for big imbalances, big crises waiting to happen. So I've got my antenna out there, but I frankly don't see anything right now that, you know, is like the dot-com blow-off or the subprime extremes that's just waiting to happen. Yeah, you can easily conjure up a possible shock. I mean, if you got a big collapse in oil prices or a big increase in oil prices, either way, it could be disruptive. If China, if their debt problem suddenly got out of hand, that could do it. If we got a big war in the Middle East, you know, it'd come up with anything. But I don't see anything that's just sort of saying there, this is just a matter of time until this happens. About the only thing you might point to right now is that stocks are very expensive, so it might not take much of a trigger to bring them down. But what is that trigger? I just don't see anything that you just point to and say, boy, we better take cover.
You know, that was the interview that Jim did with Gary Schilling on the Premium Channel on Friday's show. Just one clip of the whole. It was about an hour-long program.
But as Gary was talking about, you know, he's in cash because not only stretched valuations for the market, but recessions are a fact of economic life. And everyone knows it. It's kind of like the changes that come about with the weather each year. And they're predictable because we know it's just part of a normal business cycle, just like the seasons of nature. And what we do know is that this economic recovery is now in its eighth year, heading to nine, and it's the third longest on record. And unfortunately, when recessions arrive, they are unannounced and we don't know about them until we're in the middle of one. I mean, think back. The last recession began officially in December of 2007. We really didn't know we were in the middle of one until the Lehman Brothers event, which erupted in September of 2008, almost a year later. So when they start, you don't know, but there are some signs that were there. But at the meantime, the market was going up. It had peaked in October of 2007, and the LEIs had peaked earlier, but it wasn't until December, and it wasn't until the following October that everybody said, oh my goodness, we're in a recession. So there are a number of studies that have come out recently by Bloomberg and Moody's that did stress tests on the financial condition of our 50 states. Now, why that's important, one of the things that we do is we follow, for example, the Philly Fed indicator in the state of all 50 states. We watch that rather closely. So we just don't want to know just what the U.S. economy is doing. You start to pick it up when you start to see it in key states, California being one of them. So the same thing you want to do, the same thing when you're looking at municipal bonds. In other words, what could happen in the next recession to municipalities and states? Because they're different than the federal government. Number one, they don't have a printing press, and state governments have to balance their budget. So these are the kind of things that are studies that are coming out, and the reason the credit agencies are looking at them is everybody knows that eventually we're in the eighth year of recovery. We're going to have another recession. And if we do, how is this going to impact the states?
Well, I guess the impression some people had was that things should be getting better by now and improved, at least in most states. I mean, California, theoretically, the state where you are, Jim, has raised taxes several times to cover budget deficits. Theoretically, other states have done that. So I would think things would be getting better in this area.
You would think that, but that, John, just isn't the case. According to a couple studies, one was done by Moody's, one was done by Bloomberg, 16 states have the funds they need to handle the next recession, because the last recession lasted a couple of years. And usually when they look at a recession, states should have reserves to make shortfalls and handle, let's say, a two-year span where you have falling revenues. Even though the recession may last a year, it may take a while for the economy to recover or the state's own economy to recover, where tax revenues are right back up again to meet state budgets. 19 states most have most of what they need, but would have some difficulties in the next recession. Something will have to happen. And then here's the thing, 15 states, John, have significantly less funds than they need to handle the next recession. These are states, that are could be or find themselves in economic difficulties, and along with those difficulties, the owners of municipal bonds in those states. So these are the basically the results of this study, and we're going to get into the weeds here as to why these conditions exist and why they exist now when they shouldn't have. In other words, what has changed given the last recession?
You know, that really surprises me, Jim. I mean, given the length of the recovery.
Yeah, that surprised, and I think a lot of the credit agencies. And the problem is, if you take a look at the Great Recession, which lasted nearly 2 years, state and local governments shedded 750,000 jobs. And a decade later, remember the recession began in 2007. So a decade later, payrolls have not recovered to pre-recession levels, even though we are now 10 years from the beginning of a recession and 8 years into recovery. A lot of the credit agencies also are looking into what was different in the last recession. In other words, you'd never seen layoffs to this magnitude in cuts. And this is just not just several states. It's across a wide swath of states in this country. In local governments, what they found when they began looking deeper, not just at the state level, but also at the local level, was very alarming. And it really was, to quote Reinhardt's book, it really was different this time for states than previous recessions, given its severity, and it had the greatest impact at the state level. Every state was forced in one way or another to take some form of extraordinary fiscal action, either by raising taxes, which is what my state did, or cutting expenses. And what was really amazing is they took a look at this, and you know, this is just following logically what would happen in a recession. Number one, recessions impact the revenue side, which is taxes, as well as the spending side. And there's an indicator out there that's a first sign that any state treasurer should pick up on, knowing that the state is heading for trouble. It's kind of like the watchman on the Titanic on the tower that spotted the iceberg. Okay, this is an indicator that state treasurers know very well and should be alerting the legislature and especially the governor. And the first sign is a decline in tax revenues. You start to see that. And tax revenues are a function of the economy. As economic activity slows, tax revenues begin to decline. What happens? The economy slowing down, sales for companies slow down, profits begin to be squeezed, labor costs go up. But here's the canary in the coal mine, and this is what every treasurer in every state knows, is Medicaid enrollment jumps as unemployment rises. So somebody gets laid off from work, they have a family, or they have just themselves to take care of. A lot of times they apply for Medicaid because they're out of work. And Medicaid enrollment starts to rise along with unemployment. So there are two signs that every state treasurer knows and looks at that he or she should be alerting the governor and the state legislature and saying, hey, our revenues are starting to decline, unemployment is starting to go up, our Medicaid enrollment is going up. That's a sign that you're headed for a storm. And the thing that makes states so much different than the federal government and states and local governments, it's a zero-sum game when it comes to budgets. Every additional dollar that is spent on mandatory programs such as Medicaid is a dollar that can't be spent on other programs such as education, safety, infrastructure, roads, bridges, and dams. And we really saw that, John, in the state of California. Our roads are in such disrepair. Our bridges are in disrepair. Dams, you name it, the state's infrastructure is in bad need of an upgrade. And that's not just for the state of California. According to the civil engineers report that comes out in March, we did a show on that, the state of the nation is like D minus. So this is something that happens because Medicaid is mandatory. And as you get into a recession, as more people go on, let's say unemployment, as more people go on Medicaid, those are dollars that are going to be subtracted. You're going to have increased spending. And what, as we saw in the last recession, states had to come in and drastically slash spending because they had to make up for it because they had more people. They were on unemployment and Medicaid. The result is states have become more vulnerable to recessionary budget changes on the spending side of the ledger than they have in past recessions.
You know, and this isn't too much different, Jim, than what we're seeing at the federal government level, where it seems to be mirroring what's happening in at least a number of states. And that is where, what are we saying? Somewhere between 50 and 70% is Social Security, Medicare, and other social spending.
Yeah, between Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt, which is for the first time growing in 8 years because interest rates have gone up, is that's 70% of the budget. And one of the things, the difficulties that the Republicans are having passing tax cuts is figuring out how to pay for them, because now Obama doubled the debt from $10 trillion to $20, just as his predecessor doubled the debt from $5 to $10. But now the U.S. has $20 trillion in debt, and unlike Obama, who experienced his presidency with falling interest rates on the national debt issuance is starting to rise for the first time in 8 years. The other uncertainty in today's fiscal environment, though, may not always be able to count on, let's say, the federal government to help them, because the federal government has its own issues now. Whether they're dealing with entitlements, Social Security or Medicare, as we just spoke about, there was trouble with the Disability Trust Fund, which had to be solved by basically taking money from Social Security in 2015. So the federal government has its own problems that it has. And part of it is the massive amount of debt the federal government has amassed under two presidents, both Bush and Obama. And there are a number of things that I think have also changed. And I know several major states are facing fiscal crises with funding pensions. And that's another issue that's being looked at and is weighed in by several of the credit agencies because, for example, my own state of California, several of the cities have defaulted on their municipal bonds. And the problem, the root cause of it, was funding pensions. And our state and local pensions are grossly underfunded in all 50 states. Very few states that have got that under control. Scott Walker was one governor that was brave enough to take that on. But another aspect that changes is that in recessions, impact revenues differently than they used to. And that is a major issue.
You know, that surprises me too, Jim, because we know that in recessions, revenues drop. But why different than in the past?
If you think about what happens, you go into a recession, people lose their jobs, company profits fall. In fact, you may even get losses. You're no longer getting money from capital gains. All of that happens. But what has happened as a result of the way states get their tax revenues, they're relying more and more on high-income individuals. In other words, progressivity for their tax rates. So the more progressive the tax rates, the more reliant that state has become on high-income earners. We'll get into the weeds here in just a second. But many states are increasing their personal tax rates for the high end. And this was very true with my own state here. And personal income tax revenues are much more volatile than, let's say, sales tax because they are explicitly linked to personal income and not personal consumption. So if you take a look at your revenues, if you're, let's say, executives or your business, your revenues are coming down. Okay, that what does that mean to the state? It means they're going to get less in tax revenues. So even though your revenues are coming down, you may not change what you need to spend. You're not going to stop going to the grocery store. You're not going to stop putting, let's say, gas in your tank. Your general living expenses continue. But here's how it hits those high-income individuals. Think of executives in my own state of California, where the tech capital in Silicon Valley. Think of all the social media companies. Think of all the revenues that states get when executives exercise their stock options, which are taxed as ordinary income or capital gains, depending on how they're structured and set up. Then also think in a bull market, capital gains. This situation has been exacerbated by states relying more on a smaller number of high-income tax revenues or taxpayers for revenue. And a number of states have added not only new tax brackets, but they've even lowered the levels at which those tax rates are assessed, like the state of Arizona. So in order to extract, what they're really trying to do is saying, hey, you know, we need to get more revenue, and you, the guy that has Larry Lots of Bucks, they're going after Larry Lots of Bucks. My own state of California, we've raised tax rates here from 9.3% to 13.3%. So we have the distinction of being the highest income tax state in the country. And we've had two tax waves. We had a major tax wave here in California in 2010. We had another one in 2012. We had more tax rates in 2014, and we just raised taxes again in 2016. So the state has been raising taxes, and we've been lucky because the consequence of progressivity is it introduces more volatility in your tax base. In many states that rely increasingly on higher income taxpayers are less diversified in their tax portfolios. And to give an example, California is one of them. California relies on taxes on capital gains and, let's say, stock options for 20% of its tax revenues. I mean, that is a big number. In the 2008 recession, those tax revenues dropped from 20% on capital gains down all the way down to 4%. And fortunately for California, social media, think of companies like Facebook and the giant it's become. Think of Google, think of Twitter, think of LinkedIn, all these social media type companies that have generated. I read in one of the fiscal reports that California made $2 billion alone on the Facebook IPO. So think of what happens in boom times when executives, their stock's doing well, they get rewarded with stock options, they exercise those options, investors pay capital gains because the markets are doing well, and it helps the state generate additional revenues. Well, what happens when you get an economic downturn? Gone are the stock options. They're still there, but they're not being exercised because the market's going down. Capital gains also drop because the stock market is in a bear market along with the recession. So even in California, and we'll get to some of the states that could be in possible trouble, is that they could lose up to $20 billion. They're projecting a $20 billion deficit, or roughly 10% of what the state spends in the next recession. And that's assuming a mild one. If it was a severe one, it would be even more. So the result was the last recession, tax revenues declined much steeper than the past as a result of the progressivity in the tax rates when you're relying on fewer and fewer taxpayers. And by the way, this same trend applies to the federal government because the top 10% of this country pay 70% of the nation's taxes. So the U.S. government is getting increasingly more progressive in those tax rates and could get even more with this next tax bill. So when you rely on fewer and fewer people to pay your taxes, you get into trouble when you get into an economic downturn.
Let's see if we can wrap this around now that we've said all of this, that there must be some implications for investors and how we manage this.
Well, it's like anything else. It's like if you're an investor, you know, what have we been telling you on this program? We're in the melt-up phase. What have we been telling you? Like the gambler at the roulette table, or let's say the blackjack table, as the chips start piling up, start taking chips off the table. Well, let's translate that into fiscal policy for a state. As the good times increase and the expansion, the business cycle expands, states should be taking some money out of the budget and putting it aside for a rainy day. And the credit agencies, if you want to get a AAA rating, you have surpluses that could handle a downturn. And they recommend a two-year downturn because, remember, there's a lag time. Even though, let's say, a recession may last a year, the last one lasted 2 years, even though it may last a year, there's a lag between the time you head into an economic recovery and tax revenues start building back up to where they were during the good times. So 2 years worth of revenues. The last recession, and one of the reasons you saw so many states get into trouble. Remember, we came out of the roaring 80s, then the roaring 90s. when we were in the new economy and states were making fortunes on people's stock options and capital gains, states leading into the last recession only had 5% of their budget, annual budget, in reserves. And if you take a look at, according to Pew Research, they did a study, 29 states do not even include economic revenue fluctuations for reasons for tapping into the reserves. In other words, a state may have a rainy day fund, but that rainy day fund may have restrictions on, saying that it can only be used for, like, say, in Florida, hurricanes or disaster relief, or in Texas, for a specific type of economic activity, rather than, hey, if you get into trouble and we get into recession and tax revenues drop, then you can tap those reserves. And this was the problem that we had in the last recession. A lot of politicians spent several years arguing over, hey, should we tap the reserves or not? So the first thing that comes into play is having a reserve that can handle a recession. Most states were poorly prepared. They're even more poorly prepared to handle the next recession. Another issue since the 2008 or the last recession was the passage of Obamacare, which placed a greater burden on the states due to the majority of, let's say, people participating in Obamacare came in through the program on Medicaid. And there's a number of reasons why you've seen a few Republican governors go against repeal of Obamacare, because their states are saddled with a huge Medicaid burden. And what happens, as we talk about, in a recession, people lose their jobs. So, number one, revenues go down as a result of the job loss. They go on unemployment. And then also, they sign up for Medicaid. So, in a downturn, Medicaid costs go up significantly. And Medicaid is similar to, like, Social Security and Medicare with the federal government. It continues to take a larger share of the general fund of budgets of most states, just as Medicare and Social Security and interest are taking a larger share of the federal government.
What percentage, Jim, would you say is ideal for states to carry as a reserve going into any kind of a downturn? Now, you mentioned last time, what was it, 5% going into the last downturn?
You know, John, with the credit reports, the thing that was surprising is there was no average state. You couldn't say, well, the average per state is X percent. Because every state has a different economy. Probably the most diverse, let's say, economy in the world is probably California. I mean, we have industrial, we have high tech, we have tourism, we have entertainment, we have mining, we have agriculture, we have military. It is probably one of the, not only the, one of the largest economies in the world in its own right, but it's the most diverse. And so that's one thing that is a strength in California, given, even though it's vulnerable, and we'll get into that in just a minute, but its economy is very diverse. But its problem, it has a very progressive income tax structure, and it relies on most of its revenues from a small share of high-income individuals. Now, you compare, for example, a state like Nevada, that has no income tax, but is supported by revenues to casinos and mining. Or you can take a state like Alaska, which is flush with oil revenues. So, John, every state is a little different. And what they found as they compiled this, going into looking at where the states were, 16 states had enough income and reserves to handle and weather an economic downturn. 19 states had 5% reserves. So once again, 5% reserves, according to the credit agencies, is okay if you just have like a normal recession, something like what we went through in 2001. It was very short, it was very mild, and it wasn't very impactful on state budgets. 5% can handle a mild recession. And that's where most states were, if you collectively, if you take the last recession. But the last recession was not a mild recession. It was called the Great Recession. And if you have a Great Recession, then 5% is inadequate. 15 states in this country have less than 5%, and there are a couple states that have less than 1%. What's more, several states have no appreciable funds or balances, making them extremely vulnerable to the, let's say, another economic downturn, mild or severe. And if I own muni bonds in those states, I would be seriously worried about the condition of those states. So, as I mentioned there, you have 16 states, good shape. 19 are kind of, if you want to say an average, let's call 5% an average. That's what existed with states heading into the last recession. 19 states have 5% in reserves, but and then we have 15 that could be in trouble. They have less than 5%. And here's the big question. We have no idea when the next storm hits. Will it be mild or will it be severe? And using, again, borrowing from weather, when Hurricane Irma was heading to Florida, it was a Category 5. And so we don't know if the next recession is going to be a Category 1, like the recession of 2001 or the recession of 91, or is it going to be a 2, 3, or 4? So 5% doesn't mean much if it's a severe recession, because that's what happened to all these states in the last recession where, you know, most states, they let go, I think the figure was 750,000 jobs that were cut, and we're still not back up to those levels, even in this economic recovery.
Well, several states, obviously, California being one, have pension difficulties. In California, there are cities which have defaulted on bonds. I don't know if cities in other states have done that, but other states are having pension difficulties. Now, outside of reserves, since obviously states don't have a Federal Reserve where they can print currency to buffer all of the nonsense they get into regarding this, is there anything else they can do?
Well, outside of reserves, and once again, reserves is the key, but also they need to have flexibility. For example, each year, the governor and the legislature passes a budget, and that's what Congress is doing right now. But what you need to do is have like some flexibility at the executive branch, at the government level, where the governor, or at the federal level, in this case, the president, can make, let's say, spending reductions in between the budget year, because the budget is put together once a year. The legislature puts it together, and then the governor signs off on it. Or what if you're in the middle of a downturn? Your treasurer comes up to you, and he says, hey, we're in trouble. Unemployment's going up. Tax revenues are falling. Medicaid spending is going up. We better make some cuts here, or we're going to be in deep trouble. So you want to give the executive some flexibility. And also, you want to remove some of the difficulty of approving a simple majority, like, for example, going to a simple majority for budget, because a lot of times, due to politics, due to filibuster, you can drag out the budget process. Also, you need to design some variable spending and know what that variable spending is that can be possibly deferred into another year. For example, if it's a mild recession, let's say it only lasts a year, you defer some of your cost into the following year. The other thing, it's just like any corporation is also, or individuals, is having access to short-term credit for liquidity, having a credit reserve. But John, once again, the best choice to begin with is to have adequate reserves. And I can't stress that. And this is the thing we absolutely don't know at this point. Just like those hurricanes that we saw this summer, we saw tremendous damage done with Irving in Texas. You saw that. And then once again, when you had Irma heading to Florida, it was a Category 5 when it was due to hit landfall. Thank goodness it was only Category 2, because it could have been much worse. And also it changed direction, which lessened some of the damage. We have no idea. It could be a severe financial crisis or crunch, or it could end up just being a mild recession. And nobody is smart enough at this point to tell you what that is or how severe it will be.
Well, now here comes the $24,000 question. Given these reports, you would be very curious on my part to know who's in good shape and who isn't.
There's roughly about 15 states that are in good shape. And at the top of the list, this shouldn't surprise anybody, it's Alaska. They have 233% of the necessary reserves. So they're over surplus. So they're probably the best shape. Wyoming has 93%. West Virginia, 22%. Texas, 22%. Nebraska, 18%. South Dakota, 10%. Tennessee, 12.8. And at the bottom of the list is Nevada, which has 11.2. It's amazing to see a lot of these states that have no income tax are actually in the best shape. And so those are the states that are best able to weather a storm because they have more than adequate reserves to weather a downturn. You have a lot of states are sort of on the cusp. They have less than 5% reserves or what they need. So they have, let's say, a wide gap of almost 5% of what they need versus what they have. My own state of California is just a notch or two of going into the danger zone. And once again, for several reasons, huge Medicaid bills, huge progressive tax structure in the state. So it's heavily dependent on high income earners. And so the combination of those two, and then also being 20% of the state's revenues dependent on capital gains. And so what do you think you're going to get when you get into recession? You're going to have a bear market. Out goes the stock option revenues, out goes the capital gains revenues.
Well, now here comes the part that I really want to know about. Who's in the danger zone?
Well, we have quite a few. Connecticut, Arkansas, Arizona, Vermont, Virginia, Kansas, Missouri, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Colorado, Illinois, New Mexico, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and Louisiana. And these are states that have differences anywhere from 6% to all the way of 24% of differences between actual and the necessary reserves to weather a downturn. And if I owned muni bonds in those states, I would be talking to my advisor, or at least reassessing the credit quality or knowing the credit quality of what you own, rather than because, you know, folks, this is what happens when you get into a recession. Just as the last one began in December of 2007, nobody was even thinking or talking of a recession until we had the Lehman bankruptcy in September of the following year. So this is the thing that we're telling you as we began this broadcast, that the interest spreads between high quality and low quality bonds have narrowed considerably, meaning you are not getting compensated for taking additional risk. And if you own muni bonds, as a lot of wealthy people do, if you're in one of those troubled states, you really want to do your homework now, talk to your advisor, look into the credit quality, and, you know, really take a look at what it is that you own, because a lot of people are very passive. Most municipal bond investors, you buy and hold, you collect your coupon, you get your monthly income, you don't worry about it. Well, the time to worry about the credit quality of your bonds is now, not when you're in the middle of a recession.
I know you do a lot of municipal bond investing for your clients. So how do you handle all of this risk? What do you do?
I mean, we subscribe to the major credit agencies. We look at that, but we use primarily Bloomberg Analytics. And the reason that I like Bloomberg, it's more up to date. Say, for example, you have a bond. They come out with an issuance. Let's say it's a city, it's a revenue bond. In order to bring that bond to the market, they're going to hire a credit agency. Moody's, Standard & Poor's, Fitch, or one of the agencies is going to do an assessment, and they're going to give that bond a rating. AAA, AA, A, BBB, whatever the rating is on that bond. Well, then they issue the bond, and then the state gets its revenues. It gets its money from the bond. The investors are getting their checks. The state's making their payments. The state is not going to spend money with the credit agencies updating their bond rating because they already got it. The only time you see that change is when you get into economic difficulties and all of a sudden now you have the credit agencies downgrading those bonds, saying, well, that was an A-rated bond. We're downgrading it to triple B. What does that mean to you? Your bond is going to drop in value because there's greater credit risk. What we like about Bloomberg Analytics is the economic condition of the bond is brought up to date, whether it's a municipal bond or a corporate bond. Because once states or corporations issue a bond and pay for the credit agencies, they're not going to spend money to go have their bonds reexamined by a credit agency because it costs a lot of money. So we use a lot of Bloomberg Analytics because it's more current in terms of the current fiscal situation of the state or the, let's say, the municipality or a revenue bond, and also likewise with corporate bonds. And we have found it to be very beneficial, not only when we're doing corporate bonds, but also municipals as well as sovereigns.
I would guess, Jim, that investors could mitigate some of the risk by investing in either a bond fund or what about a bond fund ETF?
Well, that is one way. You would certainly have your diversification risk. You don't have to worry about one particular bond, like a revenue bond or a city bond, because most municipal bond funds are going to own 200, 300 different bonds. But here's the problem. Municipal bonds decline in value in a recession, just like corporate bonds do. Why? Well, what have we been talking about? What happens in a recession? If you take a look at what happens to states, tax revenues decline, which puts the rating of the bond in the municipality, whether or it's the state itself, comes under greater scrutiny and under greater credit risk because tax revenues drop. When tax revenues drop, that's when you're more likely to see greater chances of default. So in a recession, you can see muni bonds drop just like corporate bonds. Corporate bonds drop for the very same reason. What happens in a recession? Sales go down for companies, profits go down for companies, and that puts greater risk for a corporation. And the other thing, too, is what took us into that recession? It was the Fed raising interest rates, and as rates rise, bonds go down in value. It's one of the reasons why, unless you're trading them, that we like laddered bonds or we like active managed bonds. But that's not going to get you away from the credit risk. I don't care how good the fund manager is. In a downturn, municipal bond funds are going to decline in value because the economies of the states, the municipalities, and the revenue bonds are in danger of a recession because revenues contract for states. And it's, what happens to the economy? It happens to the federal government. It happens to your local government and state government as well. But we like individual bonds because what I can do is with an individual municipal bond, I can follow its credit position through analytics and know exactly the state of that bond or the credit conditions. It's one of the things that we do. And I think you have to be vigilant. Gone are the days when you could just buy something and set and forget and think you're going to be okay. And it's one of the things that we have warned people about. The index funds, one of the problems, as I talked about with A. Gary Schilling in my interview with him on Friday. I want to talk about something that we've seen develop, and that is it's almost become a fad, which is passive indexing, where the public is coming back in the market. They're going in index funds. Index funds have outperformed, for the most part, a lot of the active managers. But Gary, it's a lot of what I call investing without giving thought to analysis. So when you take a look at a company like Amazon that's selling at 250 times earnings or more, Netflix, and you ask yourself, who would be buying a company like that at that moment? Multiple. Well, the biggest buyers are the index funds, which is driving up the value of the FANG stocks that are very popular. And of course, the higher their value becomes, the greater percentage weight that they carry in the index. And then on the other side of it is algo trading, which is dominating much of the market. So you have algorithmic trading coupled with passive indexing fund. Where's the analysis? Nobody's doing that anymore.
I quite agree, and I think there are a couple of points there that you're touching on that are important. One is you're getting a very lopsided picture. You're getting fewer and fewer people who are analyzing companies and getting engaged what they call price discovery. In other words, finding out what is a proper price. Now, that does not necessarily going to be the proper price tomorrow, but it's at least the one that people think today. You know, we give fads regardless of whether it's indexing or solid analysis or supposedly solid analysis. But you have more the tail wagging the dog here. And, of course, that has the risk that when everybody wants out, boy, that door may not be big enough. The other thing about this is that I think that this whole indexing has been the result of this long bull market. And that really was generated by all the Fed money, first bailing out Wall Street and then morphing into quantitative easing. And Of course, now you're at the point where people say money has no place else to go. Fixed income returns are low, and a lot of people, you know, they're not willing to accept low returns. If they were, it wouldn't be a problem. And adjusted for inflation, they're not that bad. But people say, I deserve to have 5 or 6% returns at a minimum. So they go out on the risk curve, and they go into emerging market debt and bonds, but also into stocks. So you have that kind of bias. And, you know, I'm the type of guy, as you know, whenever everybody's on one side of the boat, I kind of want to gravitate to the other side because I think it may tip that way. And I think this whole thing is simply overdone.
Okay, Jim, let's supposing that I'm an investor and in my portfolio, I have a lot of investments in one of these troubled states in one form or another. Can they give you a call and talk about maybe what recommendations you'd make for them?
Sure, we'd be glad to talk to them. You can give us a call at 888-486-3939. But, you know, whether you have an advisor, you know, if you are in one of these states, whether you're in a state that is in a category where they just have 5% or less, or you're in one of those states that are in the danger zone, you really need to take a look at this because, you know, it's like anything else. You don't think about this. It's like that hurricane. You see them offshore. They start off of West Africa and they're out there. You don't know when they're going to hit. You don't know how severe they are, or you don't know you're going to dodge a bullet. Maybe the hurricane goes off, heads east, and never hits landfall, and you're out of danger. These are the things you don't know. It's like the old Warren Buffett saying, until the tide goes out, you don't know who's swimming naked. And that's the problem. And that's one of the things that came out of these two reports that analyzed municipal bonds, is that was one of the things that came out of the last recession, because most states had 5% on average in reserves, which would have been okay if we had a normal recession like we did in 2001 or 1991. But we didn't have a mild recession. And that's where the trouble began. So do yourself a favor. Talk to your advisor. Give us a call or look at what you're doing. Do your own homework. But if you are in one of those areas, now's the time to be looking at these things. Not when, I don't know, 12 months, 18 months from now, when we're in our next recession. Because let me tell you, folks, whatever the politicians tell you, they haven't repealed the business cycle, nor has the Federal Reserve. Sooner or later, and more likely sooner, we will be in another recession.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
One of the lessons that came out of the Great Recession was that it matters whether or not you are prepared for the next recession. That goes for whether or not you're a Fortune 500 company or you're a state or a local government. And what we found going into the Great Recession was that most states were unprepared for any downturn, let alone one the size of the Great Recession. And that made a big difference for how they did economically after the Great Recession. So if you look at one of the reasons why the Great Recession was followed by the not-so-great recovery was that the jobs that we regained during the recovery were not the same jobs that we lost during the recession. And a big piece of that was from state and local governments. So because they were unprepared, state and local governments had to take extraordinary fiscal actions that they wouldn't otherwise take in order to balance their budgets, because state and local governments have to have balanced budgets, unlike the federal government. So as a part of doing that, they had to lay a lot of people off. Over 750,000 workers from state and local governments were laid off during and after the Great Recession. We're still missing about 300,000 of those. And one of the reasons why those job losses were so severe was because states just weren't prepared, didn't have any reserves or any way of kind of buffering themselves from the impacts of that Great Recession.
Welcome Welcome back to the second part of The Big Picture. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. Well, here we are. We're looking at the final quarter of the year where economic growth picked up. Friday, as a matter of fact, government reported that despite the damage from hurricanes, the economy grew at 3.1%. in the third quarter of the year, something we haven't seen in 8 years so far. The stock market hit another record this week as economic growth is accelerating in the U.S. and also globally. So now the question is, the lifeblood of economic growth tends to be oil and natural gas, notably oil here. That's going to be our focus. Demand for oil is growing along with the economic growth. So what does all of this mean?
I have no clue.
Well, I knew that. But I had to ask it anyway. It's plot exposition. It has to go somewhere, you know.
Now, on a serious mode, what we have here on Friday is oil prices breaking out almost near $54 a barrel. We've taken out a sort of a resistance level around that 52. And what we had, John, at the beginning of the year, we had oil prices take off after the election, and especially after the OPEC cuts were announced. We got up to the $55 range. People were predicting 60. I think we have a good chance to hit 60 if things continue on the present course. But then all of a sudden, there was a glut, and it didn't drop as much. A lot of that had to do with OPEC countries increasing production ahead of the cuts that began in January this year. So there was a glut in the markets, and we've seen that with this up and down move with oil prices. And now on this Friday, we're breaking out, which is for if, you know, there's been a very few oil bulls. We've had a couple of them here on the program. And as you heard in hour one, Kurt Wolf is very, very bullish on the oil sector. But oil supplies are tightening and eventually coming into balance. Now, U.S. crude inventories are falling rapidly as demand picks up and supply is reduced. In fact, imports into this country are down by almost 500,000 barrels a day from last year. Most of that, by the way, is coming from actions by Saudi Arabia, which is going to have its IPO. That looks like it's still on track for next year sometime. And that was something we touched upon in an earlier show, that Saudi Arabia was also pressing basically other suppliers in OPEC. They were cutting back production, but they were also making up the difference by selling additional oil out of inventory. And this was something that the Saudi oil minister found when he went to a conference of hedge fund managers saying, you know, why is the price of oil going down? We're cutting back production. We're doing what we said we're going to do. Compliance is very high. And the hedge fund managers were basically saying, yeah, you guys are cutting production, but we're watching oil tanker traffic. That hasn't changed much at all. So the Saudis began to place emphasis within OPEC about actually oil exports. So it's not just enough to cut. If you're cutting your production, but at the same time you're selling oil out of inventories, well, you know what? You're still producing the same amount. And that was something maybe the oil market was picking up at the beginning of the year. That has now changed now as less oil is imported into the U.S. That's helping to shrink the supply. And that is something that has been positive. And I think this breakout that we saw on this Friday had a lot to do with economic growth picking up. That's two quarters, back-to-back quarters of 3% economic growth. It was widely anticipated with those hurricanes that would be disruptive, especially to what happened to the energy sector along the Gulf Coast. But that wasn't the case. We hit 3.1%. Now, granted, this is the first estimate. They could always revise it higher or lower, but still, you know, John, we haven't seen back-to-back economic growth of 3% in over 8 years. So the oil markets are breaking out and bullish. And so this trend could be pushing us higher towards $60 a barrel, where some of my guests on the program have been predicting that we'll hit by the end of the year.
So, Jim, what about shale oil production in the U.S.? Now, that is up. So theoretically, that should be having some influence on all of this.
Well, when it comes to oil production, it's rather interesting. We have two figures. We have the EIA, which bases its production based on estimates. These are models. And then we have actual production. And the EIA was estimating that U.S. shale production would increase by 1 million barrels a day this year, which, you know, would basically, with increased production from Nigeria and some of the African nations, would sort of negate whatever OPEC was doing. I mean, if we increase it 1 million barrels, and then let's say Iraq production increases in Nigeria and Libya, because that's, you know, we've seen increases recently from Nigeria and Libya, and then the U.S., well, that basically negated. That was the premise or the thesis that the oil markets were bearish on. They were saying, basically, look, OPEC, you're cutting production, but it's being made up by U.S. shale producers. Well, industry experts like Harold Hamm of Continental Resources thinks the figure could actually be half that. And the fact is, U.S. output has been flat since early 2017, and the EIA has adjusted its forecast lower as data replaces sampling algorithms in their forecast. And this is so true with so much of what happens in the oil market and the economic markets. And this is something I learned from the late Matt Simmons early on, is that you don't take these numbers when they come out with inventory levels or production levels. They're not gospel. They're models. They're based on algorithms, based on past trends. And so it's like economists predicting what they think is going to happen in the future based on past trends. It's the same thing with the EIA and the IEA. Now, here's an interesting fact. The EIA has been revising inventories lower, production lower, and the IEA has been revising demand higher as it goes back and fills in what was forecast with the sample with actual data. So we're seeing two things. The market's beginning to adjust. Now, what would this imply? If the trend is for falling production, for falling inventories, guess what happens? It changes the algorithms that will be coming out of the EIA. So we could be going almost in the opposite direction if this trend continues. But the real issue plaguing the industry here is the lack of personnel and equipment to meet demand for well completions. Because if you look at the downturn from 2014 to 2016, over 200,000 oil workers were laid off. And John, this is something you just don't flip a switch and some guy you laid off 2 years ago, he's sitting there anxiously waiting to come back to work. There's a shortage of equipment and a shortage of workers. And that's something that's not going to be corrected anytime soon, is one of the issues that Kurt Wolf and I talked about in hour one, is investors are demanding of oil company. It's kind of like, show me the money. Look, we're not necessarily interested on growth and you pursuing increased production, because all that's going to do is drive the price down. And that's not going to help your profits. It's not going to help share buybacks. It's not going to help earnings or dividends. And so a lot of the oil companies have been reluctant to spend the billions of dollars necessary to go out and drill or find new oil. Instead, shareholders, and many of them are becoming shareholder activists with the oil companies, are saying, you know what? Give us some of this money. You know, we're tired of waiting because the oil sector has underperformed the rest of the market. So oil companies are unlikely to go out and spend a whole bunch of money to go out and explore and drill, which means they're unlikely to hire a whole bunch of workers. So this lack of personnel and equipment can persist for quite some time, because no oil company in their right mind is going to go out, especially with the weakness that we've seen back and forth this year in oil prices, because these projects, even in shale, you know, it takes a lot of money. And you're not going to spend that money if you don't think you have the confidence that prices are going to be up there and be maintained at a high enough level. In other words, well above 50. Because remember, we started out this year above $50 a barrel, and then we got all the way down in the summer where we got down to $42 a barrel. We had a 20% correction. Technically, that's a bear market. So this is one thing that I think is going to persist and be with this for quite some time.
So if we do follow these oil market trends then, Jim, which we can see beginning to tighten, but what you're doing here is, I think you're anticipating that oil prices are headed higher, probably pinging around $60 a barrel. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that stands a good chance now, and especially now that we've taken out a hurdle of 52. We're almost at close to $54 as oil has broke out today, especially with the economic news. But, you know, there's something else, John, that's also going on here that I think we need to touch upon, because oil is not just about supply and demand. There's another aspect to the oil markets that we have not paid a lot of attention to, although some people have commented on, and that is the geopolitical risk. And we're now starting to see a geopolitical risk come back into the markets in the price of oil. And that is something that could also bolster oil prices going forward, because just look at what's going on in the Middle East right now, or even around the globe, and there's plenty of geopolitical tensions.
Yeah, but looking at all the geopolitical risk we've seen over what, the last 2 or 3 years, it still doesn't seem to have made much difference.
I think there's a good explanation for that. The reason for that complacency has been the glut of oil that came into the markets between 2014 and 2016. When OPEC made the decision in November of 2014 to go all out and produce as much oil, you know, OPEC's gamble was they were going to drive the American shale industry into bankruptcy. And indeed, when oil prices got down to $26 a barrel, there was a period of time where basically, you know, there were companies that were going under. But with low interest rates, the industry adapted. They've brought down the price of break-even points for shale oil. There are companies around today that can make money at $40 a barrel. In fact, the big guys, the big companies like Exxon, Chevron, are moving into shale as well. So all of this oil production and this oversupply in the markets created a cushion, because at one point, production was exceeding daily consumption by almost 2 million barrels a day. And all of that led to the inventory levels rising to over 370 million barrels over the five-year average. So what did this mean for the oil markets? Is anytime you saw political disruption, whether it was in Iran, Iraq, or any other place in the world that could possibly disrupt oil supplies, Africa, Libya, Nigeria, etc., you know, is there was a lot of complacency in the markets. Everybody said, kind of like the old Alfred E. Newman, why me worry? Because there was plenty of oil. I don't care if you were looking in storage, if you were looking on tankers, geopolitical disruptions were ignored by the market. There was just basically no worries because the market was oversupplied. It's only when you get into a tight market, and we did see a brief spike once, and that was in at the end of 2015, when you had the fire in the Canadian Sands oil region that took 1 million barrels off the market. Now, we did get a brief spike during that, but outside of that, any geopolitical tensions, I don't care if it was Libya shutting down their oil fields, Nigeria shutting down their oil fields, anything going on in Iraq, in Syria, in the Middle East, none of that had a supply because nobody was worried because there was so much oil in storage and on tankers that nobody was really worried.
So here we are today, and where does that bring us?
If you take a look at what they're reporting, I don't care if it's the IEA, the EIA, the glut is beginning to diminish. So why? Number one, there are four fundamental factors, I think, that are driving this. One, global growth is accelerating. We had the IMF come out a couple of weeks ago. They bumped up their global economic growth for this year to 3.6%. Next year, they're bumping it up to 3.7%. In the second quarter, you had U.S. GDP grow at 3%. And then on this Friday, they just reported that third quarter GDP, despite the hurricanes, was at 3.1%. What does faster economic growth mean? It means that we're consuming more energy. Our economy is still a fossil fuel economy. Higher economic growth, higher oil consumption. And the other thing is, I think there have been a lot of reports coming out of China lately that the oil markets have been underestimating demand for oil coming out of China. So that's number one. Number two, production is falling along with inventories, and that has now become a trend. Number three, major suppliers from Latin America, from Brazil to Venezuela to Mexico, are seeing falling production levels. You're also seeing it in some of the African nations, and you also saw it in some of the conflicts that are going on in the Middle East itself. And so what does that translate to? All of these factors equal number four, the cushion of excess supply is shrinking. And it's kind of like having reserves that we talked about in the first part of the big picture. If you head into a recession and a state has a lot of cash reserves, you can weather the storm. The same thing applies to the oil market. When you have plenty of oil in inventory, you have a cushion. So it gets back to like what the U.S. did after the oil embargo in the 70s. We built these strategic oil reserves, and most major nations are doing that, from the U.S. to China to Europe. They build up this oil reserve supply because we know this market is subject to disruptions, especially geopolitical disruptions. And so now that this cushion is shrinking, any kind of geopolitical tensions could have an impact and spike the oil markets.
If we posit the idea that there could be hotspots disruptive of the oil market, where would we expect to find them?
You know, where you would expect to find them is where you would expect to find them, which is the Middle East. And there are two areas that are hotspots. The first of them is the tension that has been building in Iraq following the Kurdish independence referendum. Now, if you've been following the news, on September 25th, Iraq's Kurdish population voted decisively for independence. It's almost like what's going on in Europe with Catalonia, in a non-binding referendum. Now, the ballot included three provinces of Iraq, Kurdistan, as well as this would disrupt a major oil region, especially Kirkuk, which is a major oil-producing region in Iraq. That produces anywhere from 350 to 400,000 barrels a day. That area is controlled by the KRG, or the Kurdish Stan Regional Government, and they export that oil through a pipeline that goes to ports in Turkey. Now, Turkey does not want to see an independent Kurdistan, nor do the Iraqis. So oil production has been affected by this, and they're reporting basically through the pipeline the flows have dropped from 570,000 barrels a day down to 200,000 barrels a day. So that's affecting the region. However, even though Turkey may threaten the Kurds, remember, Turkey earns a lot of revenues from the oil that goes through that pipeline through the country. So experts saying that, you know, it's unlikely they're going to shut off oil coming from Kurdistan, because that also shuts off revenue to the Iraqi government and also to the Turkish government. Now, the second one is an area that has been in the news lately, and that is the Iran nuclear deal is back in the limelight. In 2015, led by the U.S., a number of countries from the U.S., China, Russia, and the EU eased sanctions against Iran. Now, what did that do? It allowed Iran to increase its oil production by 1 million barrels a day. Now, you think about it, that was 1 million barrels, and also with the production cuts within OPEC, there was an agreement reached with the Iranian government that would allow them to gradually increase their production, which was down as a result of sanctions. So basically, under this agreement, it requires the U.S. president to certify Iran's compliance every 90 days. And on October 13th, President Trump did not recertify the deal, expressing concerns of flaws in the deal itself. Now, our U.S. Secretary of State, Tillerson, has given Congress three options. Option number one is reimpose sanctions. What would that do? That would remove 1 million barrels from the market. Can you imagine, John? We'd be over $60 a barrel if that happens. Option number two, make no changes from current sanctions associated with the agreement. Or three, find a third pathway, such as amending the agreement. So Iran's president has said, in no way are we going to go back and renegotiate that deal. So it's sort of an uncertainty with this president, which is what he may do if Iran, let's say, continues to sponsor terrorism and promotes aggression, like sending their gunboats against U.S. ships or doing something like the North Korean dictator is doing, firing rockets. So if they do something aggressive, Trump could do something that could hurt the economy of Iran very directly, as the U.S. Congress just reimposed sanctions. That immediately would remove 1 million barrels from the market overnight. So Iran is back in the limelight. So these are the two areas of tension, because these are big oil producing regions within OPEC, and two of the biggest suppliers within OPEC over the last decade has been increased production coming from Iran as a result of the lifting of sanctions, and also increased Iraqi production. So something happens in Iraq, or sanctions are reimposed against Iran, this market would tighten and you would see oil spikes overnight. So that's why you're seeing this geopolitical premium come back into the market, is because the cushion that we have is being drawn down. And so as inventories continue to fall and production continues to fall, that's why we anticipate that we're going to see higher oil prices.
I guess if we put this together now in a compendium, the reason we're anticipating higher oil prices, number one, economic growth is accelerating. That's both in the U.S. and globally. However, production is falling and inventories are shrinking as well. At the very same time, geopolitical risks are rising, and all of these would seem to forecast rising oil prices.
That's the way we're looking at it. We think that the train is leaving the station and we're heading for higher oil prices and tighter oil markets at the end of this decade. Because one of the things Kurt Wolf and I talked about, and that is kind of like what I call it, show me the money. A lot of investors are basically saying to the oil companies, we want to see some kind of return, because the energy sector has been the worst performing sector within the S&P this year. So companies are holding back on exploration and major projects. What is that going to mean? At the end of this decade, oil is going to suffer from two things. If you're an oil company and you're producing oil, that oil you sell today has to be replaced eventually. So what you could see is a tighter oil market, because companies aren't spending the money to develop and go out and explore and look for oil, because the projects are very expensive. They're long duration projects. It takes 5 to 10 years to bring a major oil field into production, especially if you're going offshore or major oil fields. Shale's a little bit different. It's a faster payback and less of an investment. But nonetheless, towards the end of this decade, we expect tighter oil markets, and you can see the pendulum swing in the opposite direction. And then the other thing is, you know, the thing that you're going to see with energy stocks themselves is shareholders are saying, you know, we want some kind of return. So you are seeing companies initiate discipline. And look, if you're an oil company, you have to do that, because who knows? We could be in a recession, and everybody knows we're getting in the latter stages of a business cycle when demand for oil increases. But following the latter stages of a business cycle is a recession, which means demand for oil would fall. So companies are reluctant to make those big investments. And that's why we could once again find ourselves in trouble with tighter markets towards the end of the year.
And we bring it down now to investments. Given where we see everything's heading, how does that affect investments in the energy sector?
Well, I mean, it's the one area of the market that still remains very cheap right now. It also does well in the latter stages of a business cycle. And if you are an income investor, this sector is rich with companies that pay above average dividends, not only dividends above the S&P or the Dow, but also dividends above what you can get maybe in a 30-year treasury. You can still find oil companies out there that have dividend yields in the upper 3, 4, 5, and even in the 6% range. And in a market where you have low yields like you have today, even despite the increase in the Fed funds rate here in the U.S. or in Canada, remember, globally, there's still, what, $9 trillion worth of sovereign debt out there that has negative interest rates, and you're looking at interest rates that historically are at the lowest point they've been in 5,000 years of history. So it's pretty hard to search for yields that are somewhat safe, because we recommend you really need to be careful, as we talked about in the last segment, if you're chasing high yields in the bond market, because the spreads between low quality and high quality bonds margins have narrowed considerably. So as an investor, you're taking a big risk if you're going into that sector. So it's one reason I like the energy sector. I'm more partial to individual stocks, and that's why I like a lot of the work that Kurt Wolf does. They're getting to be a rare breed where you actually do stock analysis, you know, basically looking at companies from a value perspective and in terms of what represents the best value. So I like the energy sector right now, John, because I think energy is going to be in play.
And coming up in the weeks ahead, here we are looking toward the end of the year already. What would we say is on our agenda?
Well, on the agenda, a big one is going to be now that the House voted for a budget. We are now, I think it's November 1st, we are going to get the new revised version of the tax bill. And there's a lot of jockeying going around. People are paying particular attention to two areas of what may come out. Actually, three. What will be the eventual tax rates? And also what they're going to do with the deductibility for state and property taxes, and also 401k plan and pension contributions. And that's going to be released next week. That is going to be a big item for discussion in the weeks ahead, as it looks like they're going to try to drive this thing through and get this passed before the year end. And so that may be one of the reasons why we're seeing the markets up as much as we are on this Friday, with record-breaking markets all across the board. I don't care if you're looking at the NASDAQ, the Dow, the S&P 500, all of these major indexes are in record territory, probably anticipating the beneficial effects of a tax stimulus coming. So we'll be talking about that. Also looking for confirmation in some of these economic numbers, as we got that GDP number print of 3.1% on Friday. So we'll see if the other PMIs are supporting that number. So a lot of stuff to talk about as we head into the end of the year. And then shortly, we'll be in the holiday season. And of course, we're going to watch what happens to holiday sales. Will we see online sales continue to be the juggernaut in the retail space? And will brick and mortar sales continue to experience declines? We'll be talking about that as well. It's hard to believe, John, that the holidays are what, less than a little over 60 days to Christmas. So the year is ending and coming upon us soon. And we'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.